This is a Connectability Radio production.
The Shared Learning Forum series of workshops brought to you by Connectability.ca and DSTO.com, helping individuals with a developmental disability navigate the justice system with Rachel Ross Vance from CODA Health, Danielle McIntosh from Griffin Center, and Katie Allman from the Ministry of Community Safety and Correctional Services.
If you know someone ahead of time, is maybe there's some aggression in the home, a client might be aggressing towards an elderly parent, trying to be as proactive as possible. And some of that can be planning what you want that contact with police to look like and asking yourself what you're hoping to accomplish, I think is important, because everyone's going to have their own agenda and their own viewpoints around clients with developmental disabilities especially, because our clients don't really fit well into the justice system, and there's been many examples where someone has clearly committed a crime, they've assaulted somebody, but the justice system isn't the best place for them, and court, the Crown, duty counsel, defense lawyers can sometimes be really stuck around how to best support the person, especially if someone gets, if they're detained on bail and they're in custody, it can be a really scary experience. So trying to get a sense of what it is you want from the police and trying to use them as proactively as possible. Many divisions have community liaison officers that can come out and help to be part of crisis planning with families and service providers, even group homes. There's a lot of really, really dedicated officers who are willing to help and provide support. Some of those supports could be giving someone a tour of the police station so they would know what it's like to actually get arrested. Because some of our clients, they see police as their friends and their buddies, but if they've beat up their 80-year-old grandmother, the police may not see them in the same way. And what they might be expecting could be very different. So trying to be as proactive as possible, I think, is important. And also knowing what you want the police to do. There's been many instances where families have called police not because they want their child arrested, but because they don't want the behaviors to continue. But when police come, they take them into custody, and then they're at the courthouse saying, how do we make this stop? We didn't want him to be arrested or her to be arrested. And then they're stuck in the system. So being able to tell families, what is it you're looking for? If you're looking for someone, the police to help transport someone to the hospital, when you call the division, to put that out there. That may still may not happen, but to include them in what your plan is, I think is really important to be able to do. And it may work and it may not, but I think being able to put that out there so that you have a clear understanding of what could occur, I think is important.
Many times a family member will call the police because their loved one is experiencing a crisis, or there's behaviors that are going on that they don't know how to handle, and they're having trouble coping. And so the family believe that by calling the police they'll get help, the person will be taken to the hospital, and they'll get the assistance that they need. Sometimes that happens, a lot of the times it doesn't, and like Danielle said, they get caught up in a system that they don't want to be in. The other sort of like thought that is out there is that if the police come, then they'll force the person into the hospital, into a forensic hospital, and they'll be there and they'll be treated. That only happens in very particular circumstances. When a person is taken into custody after they've been arrested, the first thing that the duty counsel and the members of the court need to be sure of is whether the person's fit or not. So, and fitness means whether they understand the court process, whether they can instruct their lawyer or not. And there's a very basic test that they use to meet this, to sort of figure this out. It's called the Taylor test. And it's about like six questions. It's, can you tell me what the role of a Crown is? Can you tell me what the role of a judge is, a defense lawyer? Can you tell me what the oaths are, what pleas are available to you in court, and what happens if you lie in a court of law? And if they're able to answer these questions, and if they're able to instruct their lawyer, then they'll continue on. They'll consider the person fit, and they'll continue on with the process. So,
and many of our clients are often always found fit, that they're able to answer those questions.
Yeah, and
which can be confusing for us sometimes, because, or what will happen is the judge will say something like, the judge will tell me what my consequence is going to be, but they may not understand that the consequence might be jail time or what probation is, but they can give the general basics, which is what the court's looking for.
And a person can be very mentally unwell, so psychotic, but if they can answer those questions and instruct their lawyer, then they're going to continue on. If there are concerns about fitness and the judge decides that, then they can order a fitness assessment, which is there's a forensic psychiatrist that comes to the courts, and there's one in every court in the GTA. The old City Hall Court, they have a psychiatrist every day of the week. In our court at Dufferin and Finch, they have a psychiatrist for half a day on Wednesdays, and that's all. But the judge can order the psychiatrist to see the person to assess fitness, and only fitness, really. If the psychiatrist feels that there are fitness concerns, then it goes back to the judge, and the judge decides whether he'll send the person to a forensic hospital for a further fitness assessment or for a treatment order. A further fitness assessment can be up to 30 days, where it's just the psychiatrist is assessing whether fitness is a concern or not. We can offer medication at that time, but it can't be forced. The person has to be willing to take it. If the psychiatrist speaks to a treatment order, then that means that the person is sent to a forensic hospital for up to 60-day period, and will be given medication, whether they are willing to take it or not. And it can be, it has to be in the least onerous form possible, so it could be oral medication if they're willing, or up to injections. But it's solely for the purpose of acquiring fitness, so the person can go back to the court and continue with the process. The other possibility is if a defense lawyer, usually initially it would be raised by defense, would want to pursue a not criminally responsible defense, otherwise known as NCR. And that's the person sent to the hospital for up to 30 days. The psychiatrist provides an opinion about whether this defense is available to them or not. And then if the judge agrees and they're found NCR, they're rooted out of the criminal justice system into the mental health system, and they're supervised by the Ontario Review Board. And the ORB, otherwise known as the ORB, will decide what treatment they have, where they're going to have it, how long it'll go on for. So this could potentially be a very long period of time, could be a very short period of time, but it's completely up to the ORB to decide that. So a lot of the times defense lawyers won't choose this as a defense because there's a lot of unknowns to it. They don't know how long the person's going to be in hospital, and they don't know what kind of treatment or conditions they're going to have to follow. There's other circumstances where they can be forced into initial. This is again when the person's arrested. So backing up again, the person's arrested, they're in custody, and they're waiting for the court appearance. They could be sent for a general psychiatric assessment to a hospital for up to 60 days. This is more because the judge is concerned about risk, and the hospital has to be willing to take them. So this doesn't happen very often. Very, very, very rare that it happens. That's a route. So those are about the only ways that hospitalizations can be given in a forensic system. So to go to bail now, the bail process, if the person's in custody, they've been brought to the court, the duty counsel has seen them, they decide, okay, yes, this person's fit, they can understand what's going on, they can instruct their counsel. So the person can try for a bail at this point, if they want to, or they can plead guilty. What the court needs, though, for bail is to know that the person can follow through with conditions of their bail, that they will come back to court, and that they have that they're going to be able to keep the peace while they're in the community. Those are the main things that the court is concerned about. So what they want usually is a surety, somebody who can post money for them, somebody who's responsible for them while they're on this bail. And that the bails can range anywhere from, like, the tightest bail would be you have to have a surety, you have to post money, you have to live with that person, you could be under a house arrest, and there could be a whole bunch of conditions, and it can go to the other extreme where you're responsible for yourself, you're given your own bail is your own
cognizant.
And there's very few rules that you have to follow. So it can be anything along that. But when you try for a bail, you want to have the best bail plan that you can, because if you're denied a bail, you either sit in jail until your trial, which could be a few months, or you can appeal the bail, but it costs money. You have to go to the Supreme Court. You have to have a lawyer to represent you, that sort of thing. So when you're trying for the bail initially, you want to have a strong plan. So they usually, the lawyers will try and get someone who can post money. They like to have it if you can live with somebody. Depends on what your issues are. And if the court identifies that you have developmental or mental health issues, they're obviously going to be more concerned and want more support, more supervision, that sort of thing. So it's really important, actually, if you have a client who has developmental issues and mental health issues, that if you know that he's been arrested and he's in jail, you contact the duty counsel at the court and let them know that you're involved, because the court wants to see that they have support. So if you can provide them, an appointment for when they can meet with you, an appointment with a doctor, an appointment with a psychiatrist, whatever other supports that are in place, if they're in a day program, let them know about that, like all that kind of stuff, because that increases their likelihood that they'll get a bail and they'll get out. We're at the court support program. There's one in every court, again. We can support people also. Primarily, it's people who have serious mental health issues, but it can also be dual diagnosis. It can, in certain circumstances, be people with strictly developmental disabilities. And we can meet the person while they're in the cells and work with them towards a bail plan like that to try and get them connected. The other thing, too, is the person has to have a place to live. So whether that's a shelter, whether it's a group home, or anything in between, they have to have a residence. And a lot of the times when somebody's arrested, the charge happened while they're in the home, and they can't go back there. It's almost an automatic condition that the court makes to try and protect the other people in the home. So housing needs to be found really, really quickly in order for the person to get bail. If somebody doesn't have a surety, somebody can post money for them. Then the bail program, the Toronto bail program, is there. And this is a supervisory body, really, that they meet with the person, see if they're willing to follow through with the rules and the conditions. The person usually has to meet with them on a weekly basis for the duration of the bail, which can be anything from, you know, a couple of days, not usually, to 6 months, a year, year and a half, sometimes 2 years. They have to come every single week. Unless they're working, and they can show the bail program person that they're working. But that is a way that they can get bail if they don't have surety.
So now we wanted to talk about the court process itself and the practicalities of what to expect if you're supporting somebody through that system. So as Rachel explained, somebody after their charge may either be already in custody, and you would need to support them through the bail process, or they would be out of custody after having a promise to appear notice. So when you go to court, it's really important to be on time. So court starts at 9 o'clock or 10 o'clock. People will get a yellow reminder slip of when the time starts. They usually try to do it alphabetically, and they do lawyers first. So that's another incentive to make sure that your client has a lawyer, because it makes it a little bit speedier to go through the process. But it's really important to be on time. The judge and the court clerks and the other people in the court don't like it when people are late. I was supporting a client, and he would come at 11:30, and the judge every single time had very stern words for him. So you don't want to have that set up for you already. So it's really important to be on time. It's also important to be respectably dressed, so to encourage clients to come with clean clothes on. They don't have to be wearing a suit or really fancy clothes, but to be presentable, to have their hair washed, to have some clean clothes on. And in the court, to be as respectful as possible. So that means not chewing gum, not having your cell phone turned on, not talking. So if there's something that the client doesn't understand, it's really important to leave the body of the court, because again, there's court officers who are in there who will give stern warnings and tell you to be quiet. So when clients are already nervous or feeling anxious, that just ramps everything up. So being able to have that expectation is really important. And sometimes it might be helpful to explain a little bit about who's going to be in the courtroom. They're usually quite busy, especially for a 9 o'clock call. The courts are very, very busy, so you want to be on time so that you can get a place to sit. There's going to be court officers in there that help to keep everything running smoothly to make sure that there's no verbal outbursts. There's going to be many, many lawyers that are in there. The judge or the justice of the peace himself, as well as duty counsel and the Crown attorney. So it's a very busy place. And when people come up for their turn, so their name will be called, they'll come to the front. If it's their first appearance, they might give a synopsis of what had happened. And then they would ask if the individual has a lawyer, who their lawyer is. And then they'll set another date for the person to come back. So it can be a really lengthy process. So your first appearance, even though they say it's a set date, it doesn't necessarily mean you're setting a date anytime soon. You may have to come back monthly, or twice a month, especially if you haven't gotten a lawyer yet. So that would be the next really important thing to do. At your first appearance, to go to the legal aid office. Every court has a legal aid office there. They can be busy, so if you're not able to wait, they can give you information on where the nearest office is so that you can go to help the client or family apply for legal aid. There's information in the packet around what information you would bring. Basically, legal aid is for people who aren't able to afford their own lawyer. So many of our clients would qualify for that because they're on ODSP, but they would still need to bring proof of what their income is. And then at the legal aid office, there's information on lawyer referral services. No one can tell you or your client which lawyer to choose. They may be able to give you some recommendations or a list of lawyers who work with people who have mental health needs or who are more experienced working with developmental disabilities. So it's important to include the lawyer in whatever planning you're doing. So if you have a client who calls you 50 times a day, that's important to let the lawyer know that as well, because so that they can know what to expect, and then that can help them to make a decision around how they can best support the client. And as I said, you're going to come quite a few times to court before you decide what you're going to do. The lawyer is helpful. They'll meet with the Crown to get a sense of what the Crown's looking for in terms of what the outcome is going to be. There's Crown pretrials where the lawyers would meet together to get a sense, and then there's judicial pretrials where they'll meet with the lawyer ahead of time or with the judge ahead of time to get a sense of what deal they're going to offer the person so that someone can make a decision around whether they want to plead guilty to the crime or whether or not they want to proceed to trial or if they're eligible for other supports like Rachel's program, the mental health court diversion. So that's really important as well, to start those things as early as possible. Somebody with strictly developmental disability might not qualify for mental health diversion, but there are excellent resources around potential names of lawyers who may be able to assist or different supports that you might be able to access to help support clients and families. So on the first visit to court, those would be the two places I would definitely check in, as legal aid and at the mental health office.
I just wanted to add that if your client is unable to come to court for whatever reason, then if they have a lawyer, it's also really important to get legal aid as soon as possible, because if they have a lawyer, it's possible for the lawyer to attend court for them. They can sign, it's called signing a designation, and it means that the lawyer will go there for them. It's up to the lawyer whether they're willing to do that or not. Some lawyers that accept legal aid, they don't want to be coming back to court for the person all the time, because legal aid, you don't get as much money for legal aid as you do as a private counsel, right? So it just depends on the lawyer, but that could be a possibility. So I just wanted to talk a little bit about the possible outcomes at court. So when the person's coming for the court appearances, they're making a decision whether they have, with their lawyer, they're making a decision, do I have a case, can I fight the charge, am I going to win if I do? If I go for a trial, am I going to likely lose and then possibly get a worse punishment than if I plead guilty? Do I want to plead guilty right away so that I don't have to keep coming back to court? There's all kinds of different decisions on what to do. Some of the possible routes that could be taken are a mental health diversion, which is based on the idea that people with mental health issues, if they're being affected by their mental health issues, and this was around the time of the incident, and then they should be offered a diversion. They shouldn't be given a criminal record if they have mental health issues, and they can be taking treatment in order to stabilize and feel better and move on with their lives, and the likelihood of their reoffending is lower. That's something that might be offered by the Crown at the court. It's only offered for very low-end offenses, like, you know, theft under, or minor assault, or threatening death, or, you know, those kinds of things. They're not offered for aggravated assault, assault causing bodily harm, attempt murder, like anything like that.
Yeah, nothing domestic, right?
Sometimes. Depends on the court. Domestic sometimes will be given a mental health diversion, sometimes they won't. It's very sometimes sexual assault will be, if it's very, very minor, like just a touch, or I'm in the court a lot, so it's all relative, right? What mental health diversion is that you have to be willing to start doing some treatment that you haven't been doing already. So start looking at, well, where are the needs that I have, and what can I be doing to help myself, and what can I be connected to? Do I need to see a psychiatrist? Do I need to get involved in a day program? Am I really bored? Do I need to whatever? And if you can put something in place with that person, and that helps them to achieve a level of stability and to stay out of trouble and to feel better, then at the end of a treatment period, then they would withdraw the charge. So the treatment period at our court at Metro North is about 6 months. Depends on the Crown that's approving it, and depends on the circumstances. Sometimes it could be less, sometimes it could be a lot more. But the whole purpose is for them to get some treatment and to stabilize and to show the Crown that they have stabilized by providing a doctor's note to state that, or support letters as well from agencies and stuff that are supporting them. The criteria for mental health diversion is that the person has to have a major mental illness. Sometimes the Crown will offer it for people who only have a who have a developmental disability and no mental health diagnosis. Sometimes they'll offer a regular diversion for someone who has a developmental disability, which is regular diversion in the court is usually for people who've been charged with, like an example would be shoplifting for the first time. They get routed to the diversion worker who's from John Howard who works at the court. And they get connected to volunteer work or anger management counseling or a shoplifting program of some sort or something like that, and then their charge gets withdrawn because they've done this. So they can be a little bit creative because the Crown, for mental health diversion, they're usually quite strict. It has to be mental health, but they could give a regular diversion, which is, again, same idea. They follow through with treatment. They do something different with their lives to help them feel better. And then at the end of a period of time, then they would withdraw or possibly stay the charge. Staying the charge means basically it's withdrawn, but it's held there for a year. And if the person reoffends during that year, it can be brought back by the court again and pursued. Although that very rarely happens, but it can be. Another possibility would be same sort of idea. Again, they go through a period of treatment for a time that's determined by the court, the Crown, and they might be given a peace bond at the end. Which is, it's not a conviction, it's an agreement to keep the peace via good behavior, and usually if there's a person, a victim involved, to stay away from the victim and not have any contact either directly or indirectly with that person for a period of a year. So the other outcomes would be the person goes to trial and they try and fight the charge. Something that's really important during that time frame is if the person is they do whatever they can to show that they're helping themselves. So during that time period, just in case they are found guilty at the end, if they're attending, you know, day program or anger management or counseling, psychotherapy, psychiatry, whatever it is that might help them, and then they can provide letters at the end if they're found guilty to show that they're doing this. And then that way when they're reached sentencing, the judge will look at that and be lenient because they've been trying to help themselves. Anywhere throughout this whole process, the person can plead guilty. And then they can, and you know, the judge will sentence them, and the sentences could be anything from a peace bond to an absolute discharge, which is usually the best thing, which is it's not a conviction, it's a finding of guilt, it's on your record for a period of a year, and then it's removed. And then a conditional discharge, which is the same thing. It stays on your record for 3 years, and then it's removed. And then it goes to, like, probation, custody, possibly, all that kind of stuff.
So at the Griffin Community Support Network, my position is relatively new. I've been working in the position for about 15, 16 months. And it's a partnership through the specialized networks of care to provide specialized support for people with developmental disabilities who either have current contact with the justice system, who are at risk of contact with the justice system, or who have had past involvement with the justice system, and we're trying to make sure that doesn't happen again. And it's also linked to the network in general, so we still have access to the crisis supports, transitional staffing. But my role can be more in depth and over a longer period of time. Typically, length of service is about 6 months. And a lot of the work I do is helping to connect the person to other community resources and to ensure that the community resources that they're going to be connected to either have a better understanding of developmental disabilities or a better understanding of the justice system in general to help support the person. So that can take on the role of case management supports, practical assistance, attending court with people, with family members sometimes. If an individual is living at home with family, it can be very stressful for the family member to have to take their son or daughter or brother or sister to court. So that can be a support that's offered to them so that they don't have to be going through that, because it can be quite lengthy. Tempers flare. It can be difficult days for people when they're in the courthouse. So that's the support I can give. Also, helping to present people at the clinical case conferences for people who have more complex needs and might need a little bit more assistance in the system. Also, I can provide individual anger management type of work, so individual meetings to talk about different coping strategies that people can use, different ways to manage their behavior so that they're not acting out and being aggressive is typically the sorts of behaviors that we see. The qualifications for our program are the same as with the network. People who are 16 years of age and older with developmental disability and or dual diagnosis. The fact that we work with people that strictly have developmental disabilities is a little bit unique. Coda Health has a program as well. They have dual diagnosis and justice case managers. But there's also often the requirement that they have a mental health concern as well. So a lot of what we do is, because we're the crisis network, we can become involved as a first step and then refer on to the CODA program for longer supports if there's still outstanding goals that the person would be working on. So that's important. Also being able to help people who have never been identified as having a developmental disability, which is something that I found was quite interesting. I've had probably 4 or 5 individuals who have gotten to their late 30s, early 40s, who have never been identified as having developmental disabilities, except through that they've ended up in the court system. So it's also important for those individuals to have that reciprocity in our relationship, to be able to ask people in the community to help support these newcomers to the system, basically, to understand what supports are available to them, to help get them linked to ODSP, lead agency, day program supports, so that they're aware that there is a whole sector that's out there that's able to help support them, and that can understand some of the challenges that they may have been going through, either as an individual or as a family unit. And as I said, so once that length of service is complete, then it would be referring on to other agencies if there's still outstanding work to be done. And to really make sure that the person is as well connected as possible. And because I can be input at any point in the system, it's important as I said before, if you know that someone is having difficulty, to try to be as proactive as possible, because many of the supports we would put in place after someone was charged, we could be putting in place ahead of time. So if someone's at home and is being aggressive towards their parents, because they're home all day, the parents are home all day, there's other supports you could put in place, respite, day program, transitional staffing. So trying to to think about that ahead of time to kind of avoid having to go through the justice system in general, I think can be really important as well. And I'm also always open to consultation, so if you have a question, comment, concern, very flexible, just give me a call and I can chat to you about it and or recommend other supports or services that might be helpful. So
I'm with the court support program at the Metro North Court, which is Dufferin and Finch. Again, there's a court support program in every court in the GTA, as well as every court in Ontario, actually. So we work with the Metro North Court, supported by Code of Health. The Etobicoke Court, which is at 400 and Finch West, is supported by CNHA. And the Scarborough Court as well is supported by them. CRCT, they assist the courts at Old City Hall, which is otherwise known as the Mental Health Court, because they have a designated court there five days a week, and also the College Park Court. So we work with people who have serious mental health issues that are going through the court system, and we can support them or be introduced to them at any time during that process. So it can be, you know, immediately after they've been arrested and brought to the division, then to the court, we can meet them in the basement of the court when they're in the cells and try and talk to them, see if they're willing to work with us. The major important thing is that they are willing to work with us, that they want the help, and they can recognize that they have some mental health issues. They might not be able to identify exactly what those are, but they know that they realize that they do have some mental health issues and they want some help. So, a lot of these people, we work with people at our court from 18 all the way up to senior ages. At the Etobicoke Court, they can work with youth, so 16 and up, and I think Old City Hall as well has youth, I'm not sure. But these people, they can range from people who have never had contact with the mental health system before, they don't have a diagnosis, they've never seen a psychiatrist, they or whatever, it's completely unidentified, to people that have had a diagnosis for decades, and for some reason they've become unwell, and there's been a crisis, and they've been charged. And also people that have developmental disabilities that either have supports or don't have supports at all, and it hasn't been identified, like Danielle was saying. So our position, our role at the court is to support them through the court process, to help them to get linked to whatever it is that they feel they need in their lives. So if they need a psychiatrist, if they want day program, if they want case managers or housing or whatever, we can link them. We can also, we have some community, some time in the community, so we can do some case management-like functions. We usually try and link them to a case manager if they're willing. Many times, though, that they aren't willing at all because it could be their first experience with mental health. They think they can do it all on their own. And so they'll refuse case management. They'll refuse other services. So we'll do that kind of a role, hopefully until they get to the point where they will accept one, a case manager. We assist in helping the person to get a mental health diversion or to get some other positive resolution to their court matter, and can speak to, we'll help work with their lawyers if they don't have a lawyer, and if we have consent, we can talk to the Crown and possibly help them through the court system. We primarily work, again, with people who have mental health issues. Sometimes we'll work with people who have don't have a dual diagnosis and it's developmental. But in those circumstances, it's people who don't have any connection at all to supports and services, and they really need it and they want it. Then we can step in and try and link them up until they're connected, and then we'll step out. Our criteria for the person being involved with us is either they're eligible for a mental health diversion, or it looks like they will be. So they have a relatively lower end offense. There's definitely mental health issues going on, and either it's diagnosis or symptoms, so there's some kind of alert that's going on. And they need connections, supports and services in the community. And we can also work with people if they have lower end offenses, and they need supports in the community and links to them as well. they can come and introduce themselves to us if they want help. So if they're charged with something more serious, we'll also assist them once they're already out on bail, and we can get them linked to these supports and services that way too.
My name is Katie Allman. I know Jen from way back because we actually shared a client or two over time. I will talk a bit about, I'll use a case study to illustrate some of the work that I do. I've been a probation and parole officer for 19 years, which is way too long, and I worked in the criminal justice system for 23. Prior to that, I worked in the courts. As you're probably aware, in Canada, the correction system is divided into two levels. There's the federal level, and there's the provincial level. And I looked up some recent statistics. Did you know that there are?
Probably not.
Last statistics indicate that there are 21,000 offenders in the federal system. 8,000 of them are in conditional release, so they're in the community, and the remaining are in custody. And in Ontario, there are 56,000 under community supervision in the province, and a much smaller proportion who are in custody. So the bulk of people in the provincial system, which is the system I work in, which are sentences of 2 years less a day and under. Anything that's 2 years and over goes to the federal system. On occasion, just so you know, a lot of people don't know this, an offender will be sentenced to a period of time in a penitentiary of 2 years with a three-year probation order to follow. It doesn't happen very often, but sometimes if there is provision for it in the criminal code, and judges will sometimes give it because they want the client to have the option of having access to programs in both the federal and the provincial system. So there is a liaison process for passing clients over from the federal system to the provincial system. And on occasion, and we were discussing this before we started, clients will be concurrently supervised by both the federal and the provincial system just because of the weirdness of sentencing with outstanding matters. So, and currently one of my offenders has been declared a long-term offender, for example, and he's also on probation. So there are sort of two groups of us who are working on supervising him. So obviously, there are times in the system we share information with each other, and a lot of the offenders that I see have actually been in the federal system as well. So I'll tell you a little bit about, you were talking earlier about sentences and sort of options in court. With probation, if someone receives a period of probation, they have to have a disposition of either a conditional discharge, a suspended sentence, a fine, or jail. There has to be something that is the precursor to the probation. So there's an actual sentence, and then there's a period of probation to follow. The maximum period of probation in Canada is 3 years, unlike the United States, where it's you can go as high as life, and thank God it's not that. A lot of the clients I see, actually, we call it life on the installment plan. They are repeatedly in trouble with the law, so in fact, they have multiple probation orders, concurrent probation orders. There's no such thing as consecutive probation in Canada. It's all concurrent, so the most I ever had at a client was 12 concurrent probation orders, which is ridiculous. I know it's a sign that the left hand doesn't know what the right hand's doing. There's a little less of that now because there's more communication with the courts. Now that things are computerized, there's a little more information sharing that's going on. So I'm supervising clients who have received a probation sentence, or they receive jail and I'm their parole officer, provincial parole, or they receive a conditional sentence. Conditional sentencing is also referred to as house arrest sometimes, although it doesn't always have a house arrest condition. Conditional sentencing is very controversial. It was originally designed for offenders who were not considered to be really good candidates for being incarcerated. And it was supposed to be used for nonviolent offenses. Increasingly, we're seeing it used for violent offenders. It can be up to 2 years less a day, and it can also be with probation to follow. And it is a form of community supervision, but it's much stricter than probation. It has much, much more stringent guidelines and conditions. And the consequences of failing to comply with that are much more immediate. You can go right back into custody and you can do the rest of your sentence in custody. With probation, if an offender is non-compliant, I issue a warrant for their arrest and then they sort of work their way through the system in that slow, horrendous way that it does, and often fail to comply charges appear to be withdrawn, so nothing really comes of them. So basically I just wanted to talk a little bit about what probation parole officers do and sort of debunk some of the myths around the scope of our jobs. I just want to start off with one of the myths. A lot of the time I get calls from community agencies or workers who say, can you form this client? Yes, I can. I have formed clients before, sometimes with some success, sometimes with no success. I don't have any more clout with the criminal justice system, believe it or not, than a lot of other organizations. Just because I work in the system doesn't mean a JP is going to actually give any more credence to what I have to say. And it's actually easier a lot of the time if I work in conjunction with an agency to help a client get through the system rather than me just being the sole arbiter of the of getting them into the mental health system, for example. So I don't have any more. I mean, I've gotten calls from shelters, for example, housing agencies, mental health agencies saying, can you please just get this person in for an assessment or get them into the hospital? I can't do that. I can try to help with that, but I don't have any more, like I said, I don't have any more of an in than any of you might have. The other sort of myth about our job is that we have some sort of all-encompassing legal power in terms of making sure that somebody goes to jail. That's not true. I do issue warrants for clients if they're non-compliant. I have to if they fail to comply. I try not to with clients who are developmentally disabled or suffering from a major mental health illness, because of the fact that I'm trying to keep them out of the system. I really do try to do that because the system is so coercive and it can be so difficult for clients to navigate that system. However, if they pose a risk to the community or pose a risk to themselves in some cases, I do have to charge them. I issue a warrant for them. They are arrested. They usually get out of, generally they get out of some form of bail. And then we go through the process of approaching a trial, and that can take quite a long time with people who are out of custody. But I'm not a police officer. Let me make that really, really clear. Social work, people who do social work in the criminal justice system often see probation and parole officers as police officers, and police officers see us as social workers, and I am neither. I'm in this weird gray area where I wear two hats. For people who have social work training in probation and parole, it's very difficult for them. We have lost a lot of social workers over the years because they find the coercive nature of what we do to be really antithetical to social work because they do have to issue a warrant or they do have to caution clients, and they really struggle with that. And I understand that. Across the hall from me is a colleague who is a social worker, and I know every day is a struggle for her, and she wrings her hands over the fact that she's going to have to issue a warrant for somebody. But the fact of the matter is it's part of our job and we have to do it, and there are sanctions if we don't do it. We're accountable if we don't do it. So we really have to acknowledge and accept the fact that we are in that sort of gray area where one minute I may be counseling someone and trying to offer them resources, hooking up with community agencies, liaising with other organizations, and the next minute I'm saying, if you don't get in here right now, I'm going to issue a warrant for your arrest. So there's that ongoing tension between those two roles, and it's really important for me to make clear to clients, particularly those who have difficulty understanding the system or are really struggling, that I do have those two roles, because clients who are lower functioning, who are suffering from major mental illness, really have a tough time with boundaries a lot of the time, and they see me, it doesn't matter that I'm the probation and parole officer, they'll still think that, you know, Katie's there to help me, and she wouldn't put me in jail. And it's awful sometimes when a client says, you know, why did you charge me? And it's a real struggle because I charge them a lot of the time really because I'm trying to help them, which sounds perverse. They sound like, you know, a disciplinarian parent. You're going to have to go to jail and learn from the mistake. And I don't want them to go to jail. I don't want them to be arrested. Watching a client get handcuffed is awful, especially a client, well, for some clients. Sometimes it's like, let them cuff them. But for clients who are really struggling, authority figures for them are very frightening, and to have the police come to the office and arrest them is extreme. Obviously, it's distressing for anybody, but it's particularly distressing for them, and I'm very, very, very aware of that. So, like I said, I try to kind of navigate the system. I should have said at the outset, I work at the Riverdale Probation and Parole Office, which is called Riverdale Office because it's a nice name, but we're actually not in Riverdale. I cover a catchment area, which is mainly the Regent Park area and the inner core of downtown Toronto, and the entire shelter system. So my clients, and I was just, when you were talking, I thought I should write a little profile of the clients that I mainly see. I mainly see clients who are suffering from mental health issues, major mental health issues, developmental disabilities, dual diagnosis, brain injuries, substance abuse, and homelessness. A lot of the clients I've seen when they were infants suffered from a failure to thrive. They weren't always in homes where they were overtly abused, but they were certainly neglected. And the failure to thrive has had a huge impact on their behavior. They have abandonment issues, they have attachment issues, obviously learning disabilities, attention deficit disorder, fetal alcohol syndrome is quite prevalent in the population that I see. So they're multiply afflicted, if I can use that word, clients a lot of the time. And for me, the question is, where do I start? You know, I have these clients who have all these needs. Not all of them, but quite a few of them. And usually what I try to do for a client who's homeless is I work on a shelter, you know, getting a roof over their head and working with a community agency. A lot of my clients, fortunately, are hooked up with CODA or CNHE or CRCT, thank God. So that kind of, we can work in conjunction with each other to get the client into a more stable sort of setting and then work on some of the other issues. It's impossible, as you're probably aware, to say to a client, well, I think it's impossible to say, you really need to do your community service and go for drug treatment when they're living in a park. I mean, it's just stupid. And I will not charge somebody for non-compliance if their basic needs aren't being met, which are shelter and food and medication. And I think that's a basic need as well, and unfortunately a lot of the time it's not. Our clients don't have that need met by them. So actually I ended up, I guess, being more of a social worker than I originally intended. And really, that's happened in part because when I started in probation pool 19 years ago, there were no community supports available. There was no mental health network. There were no problem-solving courts. There was no therapeutic jurisprudence. There was no attempt by the courts or the correctional services to work with other organizations. CODA was a very different organization then. It was occupational therapists. And, I mean, it just didn't have the mandate that it has now in terms of its reach to the community. We were also discouraged from having contact with community agencies back then. I know this is being taped. I'll put this out there. We were not allowed to contact victims and tell victims things, or we were only allowed to speak to them in a very limited fashion. And we were very, very constrained in what kind of information we could share with community agencies, which really limited the kind of work that we could do with clients. That has changed dramatically, thank goodness, and there's much more of an open communication with the community agencies. There's also been more training offered to probation and parole officers about clients with multiple needs. There was no training when I started. It was basically, here's a caseload, see you later, goodbye. That's changed a great deal. So we have, hopefully now, a staff that is more educated with regard to the needs of clients. But every office has a different demographic, and you're probably aware of that in the work that you do as well. The office I work in, obviously, has a very troubled demographic, a client base that's very, very needy, very draining. We lose a lot of probation and parole officers. They come in, they do their time, and they say, you know, it's been real, but I'm going to go to Durham. Or Durham is quiet, by comparison. Not that Durham doesn't have problems, but they want to go to an office where, not that it's a vacation, but where the clients are a little more predictable, relatively speaking. They have addresses, they have jobs, they have a roof over their head, that kind of thing. Some probation officers crave a client population that has those things. I actually asked to work at this office. I was transferred there several years ago because I like working with this client population. But I have to say, it's extremely draining, as you've experienced yourself. And the reason I got to know Jennifer, actually, I'm just going to talk quickly about Sid, without saying his whole name, obviously. Sid was a client I supervised for a couple of years. He was originally placed on a probation order for assaulting a group home worker. He was living in a group home where it was a one-on-one, which despite various inquests, is still being done. Obviously, it's a very dangerous situation. And he viciously attacked the group home worker who was on staff that night, severely injured her, actually, and received a period of probation. And then what happened was, he was placed on probation. He started seeing his probation officer, and I think I was working as an intensive officer at the time, so I had high-risk, high-needs clients. Now I'm an assessment officer. He was given to a probation officer, a female officer, and he threatened to kill her. Almost starting gay. And I honestly don't think that Sid intended anything with her, but she was sufficiently concerned, obviously, because of his history. And he was assigned to me as an intensive client, and I did an assessment on him. So I actually brought the assessment with me, which I can hand out, but I'll just give you a thumbnail sketch, and this may sound familiar to you. The offender's social skills, emotional health, and developmental progress have been greatly impaired by a mood disorder, pervasive developmental disability, fetal alcohol syndrome, attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, obsessive compulsive disorder, and oppositional defiant disorder. So poor Sid, he kind of hit all the marks. In addition, he manifests extreme anxiety when confronted with change or fears of being abandoned. There has also been some past evidence of psychosis. He is illiterate and cannot count. The subject has experienced physical and sexual abuse and maternal neglect. He has spent much of his life in some form of institutional care. All clinical reports indicate that his prognosis is poor, as he's extremely difficult to serve. He requires a highly supervised residential setting. The subject consistently presents as a demanding, agitated, loud, intrusive, boundary-transgressing, immature, chaotic young man. He has called the writer, me, on dozens of occasions to profess his love. He really likes me. Threatened to sick the hell of angels on his probation and parole officers, advised of his plans to travel to Europe, buy a diesel tractor, join the army, and become a police officer. So this is probably one of the worst examples of a really high-risk, high-needs client. And certainly not, they're not all this way, but Jennifer was actually his co-worker, and she was fantastic. She would escort Sid to the office for his appointments, and she was really good at getting him to calm down. Not surprisingly, he found the probation and parole office, I think, certainly initially to be quite a kind of a scary place. It was an extension of the court system. When you walk into our waiting room, there's glass there, and you have to sort of bend down and say, yes, I'm here to see, you know, Katie or whoever. And you're buzzed in through a door, and you're escorted down the hall. And we all have individual offices in which we see clients. We have to assess the risk of seeing clients in our offices, but most of them are actually seen in an office. My office is, I keep the lights, the overhead lights, the interrogation lights, I call them, off, and I use indirect lighting, and I try to provide a pretty mellow environment in my office. We have fabric on the walls, and just make it as warm and inviting as possible as a probation and parole office can be. Clients who are really agitated right from the outset, I don't see them in my office. I would see them in our secure interview room, but I try not to do that because it really sets the tone for my supervision of the client. At the time that I saw Sid, we didn't have a secure interview room. So he was obviously in my office. And actually, he was pretty good with me a lot of the time because Jennifer was with him, but also because I had very, very low expectations of his success. And I don't mean that in a bad way, but what I mean by that is I tried not to impose a really high bar for him to jump over. It was sort of, how can we stabilize him? What can we do for him in terms of getting him a place to live, making sure that he ate regularly, that he had clean clothing, that he showed up for his appointment so that I didn't have to charge him again. And Sid, like a lot of clients in this group, always reported. These are the clients who actually do report all the time, sometimes more than you're supposed to. They just show up. They want to talk to you because they really don't have anyone else to talk to. I got an email from a colleague the other day who said, I'm sitting in my office right now, and there's a probation officer, I can hear her talking, and the client is going on and on about how much he loved you, which is very nice. And I said, well, who's the client? He said, I don't know the name of the client, but this is the name of the probation officer. So I checked on the database to see her client, her caseload, and Sid is currently on her caseload. So it had to be Sid. So he's in trouble again, and this time it's for sexually assaulting someone on the subway. So he does have an increasing risk of violence. One of the things, like I said a couple of minutes ago, I'm an assessment officer, so I do the level of service inventory, the Ontario revision. It's called the LSIOR, and I believe the federal system uses the LSI as well.
Mm-hmm.
So it's an assessment tool to look at criminogenic risks, targets, risks, and needs. And Sid, at the age of 19, scored 32, and the highest score is 40. And I believe now he's at 34. So he just keeps going up. Clients will sometimes come down in their risk. Certainly when I'm dealing with clients who have multiple needs, if they have stability, if they've got workers, they've got housing, medication, programs, the risk definitely comes down. The risk to reoffend, the risk to themselves, and their lives stabilize. So I would reassess them at a lower risk. And the coercive nature of our intervention would also lessen because studies have indicated that the more frequently we have clients report who don't need to report, the more likely they are to become involved in the criminal justice system again. So the whole idea is to, in my view, is to pull them back from the system as much as possible. Sitting in the waiting room with a bunch of other offenders is not a good idea, especially for clients who are impressionable, impulsive,
vulnerable.
They're followers, they're not leaders, obviously. They get pulled in by other offenders who are very predatory. And the danger is, I don't know, like I can kind of observe what goes on in the waiting room very quickly, and support staff are very good about saying, you know, just give you a heads up, this is what was going on. But I don't know when they leave the waiting room what's going to happen. And inevitably what happens is clients get involved with each other, they become each other's co-accused, and you can almost predict which clients will get into trouble because they're followers. They go along for the ride, but was there really any kind of criminal intent? For a lot of them, no. It's that they want to have, they want to connect with somebody. For some of them, there clearly is criminal intent, but I don't think they realize the magnitude of the potential consequences. That's one of the problems. So I deal with this population, and we're seeing an increasing number of brain injured clients as well. And because of their lifestyle, bar fights, childbirth accidents, poor prenatal care, child abuse, child neglect in the home, it sets them on a very poor path from the very beginning and certainly makes them more vulnerable to being involved in the criminal justice system. And attracting the attention of the police. A lot of the clients I see they look odd. They look different. People always say, I can't believe you work with those people. And I think, you know what? I've got news for you. You're sitting next to someone on the subway all the time. There's always somebody who's been involved with the law. They don't have horns or anything like that. But some of my clients do look odd. They look, their behavior, their social skills aren't great. Their boundaries aren't great. They will transgress boundaries quite easily. I had another fellow on who's got developmental disabilities and mental health issues as well. And he was recently charged with attempted sexual assault. He went up to a woman on, he's got a long, long record. He went up to a woman on Yonge Street and grabbed her bottom. And he said to me, I was only asking for the time. And I honestly don't believe, well, her watch wasn't there. Sorry, Chris. But he was on drugs at the time too. But I honestly don't believe he is a sexual predator. He does have some history of sexually acting out, but against same-age peers when he was younger. I really don't think that he's out there to sexually assault women on the street. But I mean, the cops got him, and they, down on the ground, cuffed him, off he went to court. And to the credit of the judge who sentenced him, who was Judge Shepherd at Old City Hall, he believes in more of sort of a sentencing circle approach, more of a restorative justice. He worked with me and a CODA worker on what would be the appropriate sentence for him. It was kind of taken aback because judges don't do that very often. And this is actually quite a few years ago. This client, Chris, not unlike Sid, grew up in a very dysfunctional home. And many years ago when I started in probation, I had supervised two offenders who had kidnapped and held for 3 days a 12-year-old boy who they had repeatedly raped over the course of 3 days. And Chris was the boy they had abducted. Just talking about it is just even, I flash back on it, because the offenders were completely remorseless. And I didn't know the victim at the time, and at the time we weren't allowed to have any contact with the victim part of the system. There were no victim services in place. Flash forward quite a few years, obviously, 13 or so years, and I end up with Chris on my caseload. And as soon as I saw his name, I thought, I can't believe it. It's the same guy, but now he's in his 20s. And in the file, he had quite a voluminous file, were the police documents about this particular case. So, and he would never talk about it. He was extremely traumatized by this. He had a very rough start in life to start out with, and then this had happened to him. And I attempted to approach this with him. Chris, I'm familiar with your case. I know what happened with you, and he just didn't want to talk about it. He was so angry and conflicted, but he was so incapable of expressing it and learning to express it in a socially appropriate way. I mean, he didn't have the cognitive skills to be able to, I couldn't even put him in a group or a program. It still requires one-on-one care with somebody who is really, really committed to working with him. And he also has a CODA worker. Unfortunately, he often doesn't show up for his appointments. But she's been very, very patient in working with him and trying to meet him where he's at. But he, his behavior on the street is odd, and he looks odd. He gets taken advantage by older men. He's always wearing some brand new outfit. Chris, where'd you get that? And this guy bought it for me. And I said, what did you have to do to get the outfit? Nothing. Yeah. So, he's prostituting himself, obviously, to receive favors from certain individuals. But there's a fair number of predatory individuals out there who will take advantage of that client base. And that's the fear as well, is that degree of vulnerability. So I said I would ramble, and I did. So I'm on a tangent right now. So that's basically what I do. Not all probation and parole officers work with that kind of caseload. If you had somebody from a different office, they might have something quite different to tell you. Their area of focus may be more of a correctional focus rather than a therapeutic focus. I don't see myself as a therapist, don't get me wrong, but they may not work with clients the same way. They may be more of a, you don't come in, that's all there is to it, you're going to be charged. So I guess my point in saying that is that I think it's really important for everybody to have training in the area and to have some experience with that client base so that they realize the vulnerability of that population, and also liaise with community agencies and to have some knowledge of what community organizations do and what they're working with clients, because for such a long time there was a divide between what we do and what you guys do, or the men and women do, that there was that disconnect, a fair amount of discord in the system, which is, you know, not just a bunch of social workers with the clients on the street, and that's a completely unfair assessment of what work is being done out there. So there really is a need to connect. Unfortunately, what's happened, because there was such a history of not communicating, some probation parole officers are still a little bit, you may encounter this as you're like, I don't know if I can talk to you. You know, it doesn't have to be a release signed. Well, yeah, releases still have to be signed, but there is a way of working out a relationship. So we welcome, or as I do, and I know a lot of my colleagues do, having community agencies and workers coming to the office with a client and calling us and just saying, hi, I'm working with this person. What can we do to help that individual? There's a program at Humber College, and it's called the Graduate Diploma in Forensic Practice. I'm the program coordinator of it, and I teach four courses in the program, two online versions and two in-class versions. One is Introduction to Forensic Practice, it has to be called now, and Court Testimony and Documentation. And most of my students are frontline service providers in mental health, housing, developmental disabilities, and other vulnerable populations, or people who want to work in that field and want some practical education in dealing with the justice system. Our curriculum, we have many courses, we have 18 courses, and we focus on criminal justice, child welfare, mental health, sex offenders, developmental disabilities, and family law as well. So it really is sort of we're trying to look at sort of the whole system, so that if you don't have any training in that area, it's a good program for learning about it. And I have lots of people who currently do work as frontline service providers but are taking the program because they want some more practical information about it. Thanks.